This is one page of a very long and very good agreement for both Mexico and the United States.
While the media gaze was focused on the president's made-up trade war, what of the human beings trapped at the border? From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Also this week, part two in our series on eviction.
It's like everyone just pounded on us. And all that we were sitting there doing is saying, this is wrong.
The foundations of the current crisis are rooted in the racist housing policies of the near and distant past.
By then, the pattern had set in. Homeownership for white people, rental for black people. And we're still living with that legacy today.
It's all coming up after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Tuesday, President Trump stood on the White House lawn waving a single piece of paper.
This is one page of a very long and very good agreement for both Mexico and the United States. Without the tariffs, we would have had nothing. We had nothing.
For much of the past week, reporting on Trump's tariff threat diplomacy has focused on whether the president was lying completely or just partially about the fight he picked with Mexico to suppress the non-existent invasion of Central American immigrants.
President Trump calling off a plan to impose a 5% tariff on all Mexican goods. That is in exchange for pledges by Mexico to stop the flow of Central American migrants across the border.
It takes tariffs off the table. But was Friday's agreement already a done deal? The New York Times is reporting that the actions Mexico agreed to were decided months ago. The Times says there was...
But while the headlines concentrate on the politics of an unprovoked trade war and the latest version of Trumpian mendacity, mainly lost in the uproar once again was the human reality at the border. There, says journalist Bob Moore, who lives at and reports from the border for The Washington Post, Texas Monthly, and other outlets, U.S. policy has trapped thousands of asylum seekers in various degrees of confinement and indefinite limbo for a couple of reasons.
One is that they're caught up in a program the U.S. has had since last summer called metering, where they're only allowing a handful of asylum seekers to approach ports of entry and apply for asylum. And then in recent months, the second group has been these people who have been enrolled in what the Trump administration calls migrant protection protocols, more commonly called Remain in Mexico, where migrants are sent back to Mexican border cities to wait there while their asylum or other immigration claims go through U.S. courts.
And are these like refugee camps? Are they pop-up cities? What do they look like?
I'll talk about Ciudad Juarez. That's a city that, under best case scenario, might have shelter space for 2,000 people. I would estimate the people caught in that entrapment zone now number somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000. So obviously, there's not room in shelters for everyone. In some cases, they're living on the streets, and that becomes a major humanitarian problem for these Mexican border cities, which are generally poorer cities than what you would see in the United States. They're also very violent cities, which creates additional risks for these migrants. Nanette Badagan, who's a congresswoman from California, recently pointed out,
it is so dangerous to travel to Juarez that the State Department is telling people to reconsider travel because of violent crime and gang activities are widespread. But this is where you're sending pregnant women.
You mentioned the migrant protection protocols, which is borderline Orwellian, also known as Remain in Mexico. Instead of having to deal with migrants and refugees once they cross the border, Mexico is at pains to keep them on that side. How are they doing that?
Not very well. When the program was first created in January, Mexico had promised to give these people humanitarian visas that would allow them to work while they're in the country. But so far, we're not seeing any signs of that. So these people who are sort of trapped in Juarez can't work, at least not legally. There's no way to gain an income to feed their families. And we are generally talking about families. U.S. border agents, when they take people into custody, they generally take their documents through the pendency of the immigration court case. So in this case, they're sending people back to Mexico without documents to try to obtain work visas or to try to, for example, get access to health care. And we've had incidents in Mexico where parents have taken their children to the hospital and they're told, you have no proof that this is your child. You don't have any documents.
You mentioned metering, the process of giving access to the asylum process to a handful of asylum seekers at a time. The backlog, it's not days, not weeks, but months.
The latest estimates I heard is that Juarez has probably between 4,000 and 5,000 people on the metering list. They get little wristbands with their number written on it. Early on in the practice, they had written numbers in indelible markers on people's arms, and that was a little bit too evocative of the Holocaust, I think, and so they stopped doing that.
Then the Remain in Mexico program, waiting for a hearing just to approach the border, could take you to when?
The people who are being enrolled in the Remain in Mexico program in El Paso today are given court dates for July of 2020. So they would have to remain in Mexico for 13 months at a minimum before getting their initial appearance in immigration court to start a process that may take 2 or 3 years after that.
Assuming, just for the sake of argument, that the president was telling the absolute truth when he described this complex deal with Mexico to stem the influx of asylum seekers and other migrants across the border, would anything that he described have any effect on the reality on the ground along the border as you've just described it?
It's difficult to say until we see how things turn out over the next few months, but we do know that the administration's entire strategy has been and continues to be to deter people from leaving Central America in the first place. And we know that those deterrence efforts not only haven't worked, but in some senses they've boomeranged and helped feed the exodus from the Northern Triangle. I think what's gotten lost in the political conversation about this are the lives that are directly impacted, which would be the migrants themselves, and then the residents of these border communities in both Mexico and the United States who have to take up the hard work of caring for the migrants in their community, making room for them, feeding them. There's been no conversation about that at all. And really, if it had not been for a massive volunteer response in communities like El Paso, what is clearly a humanitarian crisis could have been a humanitarian catastrophe, and we still face that risk.
This conversation is premised on the idea that by covering the politics and the Trumpian antics of the situation, the press was fiddling while the border was burning, that our attention institutionally was misdirected.
Not only is the border burning, the home countries of these people, particularly Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, are deeply troubled. And there has been some very excellent journalism by Jonathan Blitzer at The New Yorker and some others that have looked at those root causes, but not enough. And certainly in our political conversation, there are only a handful of members of Congress who are talking about addressing the situation on the ground in the Northern Triangle as being the most important step to take. Instead, we're locked politically in this meaningless conversation largely about the wall and about border security. You know, the wall and other security efforts are meaningless in a context where people are crossing the border and turning themselves in. They're not evading capture or anything like that. And so the solutions that we've been talking about for the last year and a half have nothing to do with the actual problem that we're experiencing.
Bob, I thank you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to tell our story.
Bob Moore is a freelance journalist who writes about the border for The Washington Post, Texas Monthly, and other fine publications. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This is episode 2 of our series called The Scarlet E, wherein we probe the origins and true nature of our eviction epidemic, millions each year, and take on some of its most durable myths. One popular idea is that eviction is a grim but inevitable byproduct of natural market forces. Move along, people, nothing to see here. But the data tell a different tale. One of a plague that could have been contained had it not been purposefully designed to diminish the wealth and power of specific populations, black and brown ones. I think that's the idea that must be driving a House Judiciary Subcommittee this week to hold a hearing on the continuing impact of the transatlantic slave trade and the path to restorative justice, with testimony from the journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's made a powerful case for reparations. It's also why we've called this episode 40 Acres.
When we first created this map, this is not what I thought it would look like.
Our partner in this series is Matthew Desmond, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, and founder of the Eviction Lab at Princeton. Matt pulls up on his cell phone a U.S. map charting our eviction hotspots. The places hardest hit are not the ones most covered.
This is kind of a shocker to me. These counties are shaded here, and the darker shading means higher proportion of African Americans in the county.
It's blue.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just follow the blue, when you go through Alabama and Georgia and up to South Carolina and North Carolina, you see incredibly stunningly high eviction rates through Virginia. These are pretty low-cost areas that have these exploding eviction rates. And then you go up to Mississippi, and you can keep going into Detroit as if the eviction problem follows like the trail of the Great Migration. Black families searched for economic security and ran away from racial terrorism to go into North cities to be corralled into ghettos where they didn't own the land again. And so it's an old story. But it's kind of like our story.
The Great Northern Migration is a major way station on the road to today's eviction crisis and the interrelated racial wealth gap. The net worth of the typical black household is just 15% of the typical white one, and the gap is growing. But the path to the present moment begins even earlier, when European colonists built the nation's wealth on stolen land with stolen labor, and then fought over the continuance of slavery to sustain it. In fact, you could argue that the emancipation induced a kind of mass eviction for African Americans, and it was into a most peculiar kind of freedom.
In 1863, the Negro was freed from the bondage of physical slavery, but at the same time, the nation refused to give him land to make that freedom meaningful.
As Martin Luther King often noted, the nation was keen to provide millions of acres out west to whites from Europe as a foundation on which to build their lives, but to the former slave, it offered not a patch, not a stick.
Frederick Douglass could say that emancipation for the Negro was freedom to hunger, freedom to the winds and rains of heaven, freedom without roofs to cover their heads, freedom without bread to eat, freedom without land to cultivate. It was freedom and famine at the same time.
Beginnings can determine endings. The rate of white home ownership is almost 73%, but black home ownership languishes at about 43%. And that can be a deep disadvantage, because if you don't own property, you can't transfer it to your kids. Only 13% of kids from college-educated black families get an inheritance of more than $10,000, as opposed to 41% of their white counterparts. Actually, white families average a lot more than that, but $10,000 was deemed a transformative sum, one that could change the course of a life. So, Those who aren't bequeathed property deserve at least the chance to buy it wherever it is sold. For African Americans, it took another century plus 5 years for that right. Even then, the exclusionary policies of many banks and brokers and our laws ensured that only a few African Americans would get a toehold in the housing market before prices zoomed into the stratosphere. Which is why many argue that the wealth gap now is too large to seriously address without moving decisively to correct an old injustice.
If I am not mistaken, I once read back during that short spell I spent in school where every slave set free was supposed to get for slaving 40 acres and a mule.
In 1865, as the Civil War wound down, President Lincoln ordered General William T. Sherman to come to terms with America's newly emancipated citizens. So he and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton gathered a group of black ministers to ask what they wanted. Garrison Frazier, a Baptist minister who'd purchased his own freedom some years before, spoke for them all. Land, he said, to have it, turn it, till it, would sustain them and even leave them something to spare. Sherman then issued an order allotting the newly emancipated a 30-mile tract held by former slaveholders from South Carolina to Florida, divided into 40-acre plots, and then he promised the Army's help in supplying mules. Tens of thousands of free people settled in, and then were driven out because President Andrew Johnson overturned the order.
We had a promise. That was taken back. And when we hollered, it was, hey, Shpikuna. Well, me, I'm being rowdy, hot, and black. I want my 40 acres and my mule.
Thus was that promised parcel in the American South, recompense for centuries of barbarism, clawed back, even as slaveholders were compensated for the loss of their slaves. It took the agonies following Reconstruction, the trampling of basic freedoms, the unbridled exploitation, the gleefully executed lynchings, to spur the historic exodus of the incompletely emancipated North.
Hello, Springfield, I'm over with Chicago.
6 million African Americans departed the caste system of the Jim Crow South from the time of World War I until the 1970s.
Isabel Wilkerson is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration.
The only group of Americans who's had to actually leave the land of their birth for another part of their own country just to be recognized as the citizens to which they have been born. And it changed every single city in the North, the Midwest, and West. It changed our culture. It changed the music that we listened to. It changed literature. It changed politics.
When the Great Migration began, 90% of African Americans lived in the South. When it was over, more than half were living elsewhere.
Chicago.
In 1916, the Chicago Defender, an African-American newspaper, beckoned their, quote, Southern brothers to come north, quote, better 1,000 times to run chances of being nipped by the fingers of Jack Frost than to shake off this mortal coil at the end of a lyncher's rope. The white perspective was displayed in a 1918 headline in the Chicago Tribune, quote, fearing Negro invasion, crowd attacks house. That chilly reception, warmed only slightly by the need for cheap labor in the slaughterhouses and elsewhere, underwent a hard freeze when the Depression blasted in. After the crash, black unemployment doubled or tripled that of whites, as the latter moved in to take the grueling jobs they'd previously shunned. In 1936, African Americans finally deserted the party of Lincoln and voted for FDR. But though the New Deal appointed many African-American advisors, its programs were managed on the local level, where racism thrived. FDR couldn't afford to lose Southern Democrats, so his administration overlooked the Jim Crow laws and the monstrousness of lynching. But it was worse than that. Southern congressmen demanded that agricultural and domestic workers, guess who held most of those jobs, be barred from the shiny new programs like Social Security and the minimum wage. Black veterans were denied the educational benefits and low-cost loans whites enjoyed under the GI Bill. In these and many ways, blacks were denied the helping hand extended freely to whites in pursuit of the American dream.
Homeownership is the basis of a happy, contented family life. And now, through the use of a National Housing Act insured mortgage, is brought within the reach of all citizens on a monthly payment plan no greater than rent.
I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
What did they need? Houses. Who had the money to loan to developers? Banks. Who would insure the banks? The Federal Housing Administration. And the Federal Housing Administration had one tiny little condition: don't sell to black people.
Marty Wegbright is the director of litigation for the Central Virginia Legal Aid Society.
It wasn't just the South. It wasn't just the Northeast. It was Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Dallas, Atlanta, Miami, every place across the entire country. That's how the country got segregated. Moreover, what the government was doing as a policy was perfectly legal. And if you were denied rental, if you were denied home purchase, until 1968, there was nothing you could do. Now, 51 years ago, that got changed. But by then, the pattern had set in. Homeownership for white people, rental for black people. And we're still living with that legacy today.
Thus, generation after generation were corralled into areas outlined on maps in red, legally designated as risky. These areas, disinvested in and underserved, were snapped up by speculators and then rented at above market rate to citizens fleeing the horrors of Jim Crow. It didn't really matter how much you earned, if you could have qualified for an FHA loan. If you were black, you wouldn't. With your options limited, your home, most likely, would be located within the red lines. A fitting color for a place engineered to bleed you dry. So, there's no denying that when the nation was born, its wealth was derived in large part from theft. That's the easy part. Now is the hard part, and where the denial of fair access to land, to housing, continues north, south, east, and west. For 500,000 people on the Great Migration, Chicago was the last stop. So next, we go to Chicago. This is On the Media. On the Media, I'm Brooke Gladstone, and in this part of the hour, I'm in the second city, the windy one, the one that works with big shoulders, Chi-Town, Chi-Rack, Chicago.
Chicagoans claim their skyline is one of the most beautiful in the world, etched against the impressive clearness of Lake Michigan. Perhaps this is the scene that most catches the visitor's eye when he comes to the city for the first time. A picture of wealth and serenity.
Right, I call it Jim Crow in the North.
Chicago is the nation's 13th most segregated metro area. As the sun sets, we drive through the city's number one eviction zip code, the South Shore, with Natalie Moore. She's a reporter for WBEZ Radio and author of The South Side, A Portrait of Chicago and American Segregation. With Natalie at the wheel, we see a place of infinite variety. True, some of it doesn't look too good.
If you look here, this used to be a grocery store, Dominick's. It was a chain that went out of business, and it was hard to get a new tenant for that space. There was a police shooting. The police killed somebody here on 71st, and there was a protest.
But some of the South Shore looks grand. Many of the houses we pass are gorgeous, a mix of styles dating back a century to the present in a harmonious flow. But here, fancier houses do not mean fancier retail. Again, it doesn't matter how much you earn if people don't want to serve you.
That's the thing about Black neighborhoods in Chicago. This is a racial issue because you can have six-figure households that still are asking for some of the same amenities like a grocery store.
Out of the car, Natalie observes that the fanciest streets have the fewest outlets, the least access, gated without the actual gates. She says this and other parts of the South Shore, close to the lake and public transportation, should be worth more. But this is a Black area, so retailers, realtors, banks, and brokers have decided its value is less than what a similarly situated white one would be, and segregated its residents in the sense that matters most, not necessarily from white people, but from the privilege that empowers them to demand what they deserve.
Segregation isn't about, well, I need a white neighbor as a Black person to be better. Segregation is about resources and access, removing barriers to access. People can live where they want to live, but this idea of choice can be complicated because, yeah, you chose to live here, but what helped you? Did you get a down payment from your family? How did the bank view you? There are a lot of elements that go into someone's choice.
Tell me about your grandparents.
So my mother's parents are from Georgia. They were part of the second wave of the Great Migration. They came after World War II. And they moved to West Woodlawn neighborhood. That's the neighborhood that Lorraine Hansberry's father tried to buy a house, and the white people got mad. Lorraine Hansberry's mother had to patrol the house at night with a gun.
And in the end, they threw little Molotov cocktails in.
Yes.
And set fire to the place.
Yes.
As a young man, Carl Hansberry, Lorraine's father, moved up to Chicago from Mississippi, became a real estate broker and an activist, and in 1937 bought a house in whites-only West Woodlawn. Mobs attacked his home and his neighbors took him to court. Later, that ordeal inspired his daughter's classic play, A Raisin in the Sun.
Do you really feel...
No. Don't worry about how I feel. Come on, get out of my house.
All right. What do you people think you have to gain by moving into a neighborhood where you're not wanted? You know, people get awful worked up when they feel their whole way of life, everything they've worked for, is threatened.
Get out.
Hansberry actually won his case on a technicality. Later, of course, his angry neighbors could not have sued.
The Civil Rights Act of 1968. Included in the measure was a landmark open housing bill, which, when fully effective, would bid discrimination in approximately 80% of all housing offered for rent or for sale in the United States.
It proclaims that fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
The Fair Housing Act, also known as the Civil Rights Act of 1968, passed only after the riots caused by the murder of Martin Luther King. I'm running through history here to show that these aren't settled matters. Today, Black and brown people are still denied equal protection under the law. They're still denied access to services, even to the interest rates extended to whites. They're still excluded and still preyed upon with near impunity. But for now, let's stay in the 60s.
There are blocks like this scattered throughout the Lawndale section of Chicago's West Side ghetto. The people who live here bought their homes from real estate speculators at double or triple their value, and they bought on contract because they couldn't get conventional or FHA mortgages. Under the contract, the buyer makes installment payments at high interest, but he builds no equity. If he defaults on even one payment at any time during the contract, he loses the property and everything he's paid into it.
These contracts, common enough in some cities from the 1930s through the 60s, weren't mortgages. They were layaway plans carefully crafted to fail. The buyers paid taxes on dwellings they didn't own, and they paid inflated prices to repair damage previously concealed from them. They paid and paid. Once squeezed dry, the tenants were evicted and the contract sold to another black family seeking a toehold in the American dream. The reason for the decline of so many black urban neighborhoods into slums, historian Beryl Satter observed in her book Family Properties, wasn't because they lacked resources, but because they held riches that could be drawn from the hard-pressed but hard-working and ambitious African Americans who lived there. The problem, she wrote, was that the pickings were too easy and the scale of the profits too tempting for many of the city's prominent citizens, attorneys, bankers, realtors, and politicians alike, to pass up. Back in 1961, Clyde Ross, a Mississippi refugee, signed a $27,000 contract on a Lawndale home that speculators had purchased weeks earlier for $12,000. To make the payments, he worked three jobs from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. He hardly knew his kids anymore, and still he lost ground. Just as his parents down south had been robbed of the land they'd owned for generations, Ross saw that the hamster wheel he and his neighbors had set themselves on for a better future would only deliver destitution and defeat.
These people who have cheated us out of more than money, we have been cheated out of the right to be human beings in a society. We have been cheated out of buying homes at a decent price.
In 1968, Ross became co-chairman of the Contract Buyers League.
The people of Lawndale organized the Contract Buyers League, and during the past year, the league began urging large numbers of buyers to withhold the payments on their contracts.
You have to look at the other side, too. These people had something to buy. They bought it. I mean, the investors. And now they have something to sell, and they sold it. You're going to say because they made what is termed here excess profits.
Immoral?
I don't know if it is. You know, I talked to this student here who was saying, hey, made fantastic profits. And I said, what is a fantastic profit?
Well, it seems pretty clear if a house is sold for $25,000, which is valued by the FHA at $15,000, that there's excess profit. Right.
Possibly, yes. I won't say definitely, but possibly. It would appear that way, but not necessarily so. But there are many businesses that do make 100% profits. Not many, but there are some. And the greater the risk, they're entitled to.
Hank Roberts, a substantial man in his 60s, was 15 when his family was evicted.
Mount Bowel, Mississippi. That's where my history really, I guess, starts. My grandfather, he came here really just seeking opportunities to be an entrepreneur. He actually had his arm severed in the cotton gin. And he came here and he started his own grocery store and had one of the largest grocery stores on the west side of Chicago.
Hank takes me to the scene of his worst memory. His parents had bought a newly constructed home on contract in 1968. The street is quiet and plain.
You could imagine I was just like, seventh heaven. We're moving into a 5-bedroom, 2-full kitchen house. All my family was going to be there.
What was it like back then? How many white people were here?
Well, if you look across the street, you see that they're kind of older homes. And white families were starting to move out, but there were still some white families there. But all of this land pretty much on this side of the street was vacant. There was a builder called Universal Builders who was just redeveloping all of these lots. That area was really not welcoming and an exclusively white area. As a matter of fact, when we first moved, I wanted to get on my bike and ride around and see what the area was like. And that was a mistake because I rode south, and some guys quickly jumped me and let me know that I wasn't really welcome around here.
The Roberts family settled in, unaware that despite making their monthly payments, they'd never hold title on the house and that the contract was a scam. Once they understood, they joined the Chicago Contract Buyers League.
Why haven't you been sending your payments in, sir?
Because I feel that the contracts that we have are illegal.
I see there are so many people around. Could you tell me a little bit about it? Why are they here, sir?
We're together.
400 contracts were renegotiated between the tenants and the owners, but not all of them, not Hank's family's. It happened on a March morning in 1970.
It had to have been a weekend day. And we were all at home and we were having breakfast. And it was all over the radio.
Four more members of the Contract Buyers League were evicted this afternoon on the south side in the 8000 block on South State. At the scene, Task Force Commander William Mooney says some arrests have been made in connection with the evictions. This is John Adams, WGN News.
Quiet, sunny kind of a day. And I can recall sitting at a kitchen table and hearing like a baton or something bang on the door, like boom, 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 boom.
Police were conducting mass evictions, block after block. From his front door, he could see his older sister's house, her stuff being dumped.
When you're evicted, they don't just carry your stuff out. So, I mean, we had dishes on the table. All of that was just thrown out in the street and broken. And Getting to what you asked me on that, and I'm just going to get through the day. So ended up everything thrown out in the street. Contrary to what would have expected, people start coming around trying to steal some of the things that were thrown out into the street. So it was just total chaos. Later on that evening, there was like a torrential rainstorm. And it just destroyed everything. So in essence, my family was starting off from scratch. It was especially devastating for me because I was an all-city athlete playing football at that time. And living so far away, I was now out of the district. So I kind of snuck my way to stay here. But that was a two-train and one-bus ride to get here.
A 15-minute walk to school turned into a 90-minute commute for more than 2 years. After high school, Hank earned an MBA from DePaul University and began his professional life managing real estate. Sometimes he had to evict people.
If a person did not follow the guidelines or the rules, you know, you have to enforce the rules. So that was never a struggle for me. If I needed to evict someone, I could evict someone.
He started his own construction company, but then came the 2007 recession and a family event, a private matter, that sparked a kind of spiritual awakening.
I had to make some decisions. I'm getting older, and what was most important, making a lot of money or trying to yield to your calling, which probably included not making a lot of money, and I yielded.
Hank has since spent his life advocating for low-cost housing as a developer and founder of a community housing nonprofit. He owns a small 9-unit building that has been filled with formerly homeless veterans and some families, too. But since he'd earned almost nothing from the nonprofit, his family had long relied on his wife's salary as a bookkeeper. Once she retired, they depended more and more on the income he earned from a market-rate rental that he'd designed himself. And Catherine was a great renter, until she wasn't.
When I realized that I was not going to be able to pay the rent, it was hard for me because I was able to pay the rent always.
For more than 20 years, Catherine had held a steady job at United Healthcare. Hank offered her a good deal, about $1,200 for a big rental that even had a deep soaking tub. He'd lavished a lot of attention on the place, and she cared for it and paid on time for 9 years. Then she fell, had a concussion, seizures, heart problems, surgeries, migraines. As her disabilities mounted, Hank dropped the rent to $1,025, then to $950. But finally, Catherine could no longer work. She got some medical insurance, but no long-term disability benefits, no state disability insurance. She told Hank she didn't know when she could pay.
Social Security is a process of 3 years. Long-term disability was a process of months.
What was his reaction?
We'll work this out. It'll be okay. Don't worry about it. We'll get through this. I never met anybody like that. Never met anybody like that. Not even in my family. Never met anybody like that.
Hank carried Catherine's rent for 5 months until he himself was threatened with foreclosures, both on the rental and his own home. Up against it, he filed to evict.
How much do you have to pay a month on your place?
On my mortgage, $1,100.
Finally, Catholic Charities agreed to cover 2 months of Catherine's back rent. Her son, who she sorely didn't want to ask, moved back in to help. Despite the risk of seizures, like those that cost her her old job, Catherine started driving an Uber on and off, slowly paying back what she owed, enabling Hank to stave off foreclosure.
So, why do you think that you get so upset? You get agitated whenever you remember the stuff thrown on the street.
There was just no sympathy from anyone to our plight, from the guys that threw the things in the street to the people that were coming by trying to take stuff to. I just have to say this, the way that I saw it then, I mean, I still sit here and go, God, do you have to do it that way? It was a torrential rainstorm. It's like everyone just pounded on us. And all that we were sitting there doing is saying, this is wrong.
The storm was horrible luck. The thieves, that was brutal. But the legal exploitation, the police that enforced it, the national priorities that reduce panic and desperation to just a cost of doing business? The laws aren't written for people like Hank and Catherine. They're written for people who can afford to wait out bureaucratic delays or can rely on others to help them out. People like me, and statistically speaking, probably you. Martin Luther King.
Many of the people who supported us in Selma, in Birmingham, were really outraged about the extremist behavior toward Negroes. But they were not at that moment, and they are not now, committed to genuine equality for Negroes. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income, for instance, to get rid of poverty for Negroes and all poor people. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to make genuine integration a reality and quality education a reality in our schools. It's much easier to integrate even a public park than it is to get rid of slums. And I think we are in a new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we are getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far.
After the passage of the Fair Housing Act, African Americans now could, on paper, buy homes whenever they chose. But having missed the chance to stake a claim in the bargain-rich housing market of the post-war years, they faced dizzying prices. And then, in the early 2000s, came contract buying 2.0. Behemoths like Wells Fargo and Countrywide Financial, later bought by Bank of America, specifically targeted communities of color with shady subprime mortgages and deceptive predatory loans. The financial meltdown ignited by the scam is predicted to widen the wealth gap between black and white for at least another generation. Meanwhile, the investigative podcast Reveal reported last year that redlining still flourishes, still pushes people of color toward higher interest mortgage loans than those offered to whites, even when they earn the same. Meanwhile, contract selling has made a comeback in Detroit, Akron, Battle Creek, and Chicago. But this time the companies doing the selling are Wall Street veterans handling thousands of properties. 2 years ago, the Chicago Reader fingered three out-of-state companies doing business there, charging soaring interest rates and prices that far exceed, in some cases, the home's estimated value. And meanwhile, the new head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau seeks rule changes that would allow lending institutions to withhold the kind of data that Reveal used in its investigations, and says that the Bureau's priorities now would shift to modernizing debt collection and educating consumers rather than pursuing wrongdoers. Right. Who needs consumer protection anymore?
The truth is that no one pays his dues willingly.
James Baldwin.
The bill has come in. It's not coming in. It is in. And the great question now is precisely what we've got in the bank. This, of course, is everything we think we have. Everything. What is really crucial is whether or not the country, the people in the country, the citizenry, are able to recognize that there is no moral distance, no moral distance, which is to say no distance, between the facts of life in San Francisco and the facts of life in Birmingham.
As fewer and fewer people control more of America's wealth, increasingly we are a nation of renters, more than at any point in the last 50 years. And though eviction is not solely a black plague, neither is it a byproduct of natural market forces, because market forces were never natural. Successive local, state, and federal governments built the current crisis decade by decade, brick by brick, by enclosing the disfavored, the black and the brown, by extracting their wealth, by intimidation, by unequal justice. Eviction is an object lesson in how inequality will always spread beyond the walls to contain it. Ultimately, it engulfs everyone.
Interest's gotta go on, just like rent. I may be crazy, but I ain't no fool. 100 years of debt at 10% per year, per 40 acres, and per mule. Now, add that up. Ooh-wee, look at that. No wonder y'all call great-grandma Jewel. Just pay me that and call the whole thing square. Yes, Lordy, 40 acres.
Next week, we probe the relationship between tenants and landlords and the actual mechanics of eviction. The Scarlet E is produced by Eve Claxton, John Hanrahan, Catherine Simon, and edited by OTM executive producer Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and our engineer is Sam Baer. Our original score was composed by Mark Henry Phillips. We had more help from Emily Mann, Greta Rainbow, and the Eviction Lab team. And thanks to WNYC archivist Andy Lancet.
On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, Asta Chaturvedi, and Zandra Ellen. We had more help from Chloe Nosan. One more thing. We have developed a handy tool with the Eviction Lab team to help you explore what eviction looks like in your state. Go to onthemedia.org/eviction to get started. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for The Scarlet E is provided by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Melville Charitable Trust. Additional support is provided by the Economic Hardship Reporting Project and Chasing the Dream, a WNET initiative reporting on poverty and opportunity in America. Support for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.